Today we're going to talk about justice, and in particular criminal justice. And just like responsive readings, our criminal justice system relies on conformity. In fact, conformity is the whole basis for the criminal justice system because its mission is to serve society by handling rule breakers. Because here's the deal. At some point in time, everyone breaks the rules. Sometimes I don't want to move when you tell me to move. And sometimes the speed limit really is too low. I told the officer. Yeah, honestly. So sometimes we break rules. In fact, how many of you ever got in trouble at least once as a child? I rest my case. We are all rule breakers, which is why it's super important that we as a society develop systems that are constructive for dealing with rule breaking. When it comes to crime in Canada, we rely on the Criminal Code, which is a book of rules that are written down. You know, we're supposed to follow those things, right? And our society has adopted a really complex system for dealing with crime. It's three-pronged. It has law enforcement, courts, and the Ministry of Justice, which oversees corrections. Okay? So let's talk a little bit about the evolution of that system for dealing with criminal violations. Initially, Canada began by relying on a variety of corporal punishments, including public lashings and stocks. This is just like the U.S. too, and the death penalty. And they had, we had branding, transportation, banishment, and fines. That was how we dealt with rule breakers. And in fact, originally, public shaming and humiliation were the cornerstones of punishment here in Canada until about the mid-1800s. During that period, members of the public were encouraged to go to the public square to see who was being punished, being in the pillories or in the stocks, and to pummel them with rotten tomatoes, as Sybil mentioned, and eggs, right? That was a family activity back in the day, right? Initially, we relied on jails, where women, children, and men were all housed together. There was no separation by gender, age, or type of offense. The jails used a fee system, which required prisoners to pay for food, clothing, liquor, and sex. So you can imagine the conditions, right? Yeah. And in the 1800s, the idea of penitentiaries kind of came into play. These were places for people to go and do penance. That comes from the Latin word penitentia, which means remorse. Okay? This was a place where you would go and learn the error of your ways and repent. All right? At any time, at that very time in history, two models emerged, one in Pennsylvania, one in New York, for penitentiaries. Both were considered vast improvements. They were progressive, okay? Because every inmate had their own cell. There was an elimination of a fee system. You no longer had to pay. Your food and clothes were actually provided for you. They separated gender. They separated kids from adults, okay? Debtors were separated from convicted felons. Prior to that, they were all together. And they expected you to do some labor during the day. They then provided medical care, unheard of before that. And you could no longer get alcohol, even if you had money. And they also, the last thing was, they access to the opposite sex and prostitutes was eliminated, regardless of your wealth, right? So when Canada built their first penitentiary, it was Kingston Pen. We call it KP, right? It was 1835. And it was based on that the New York model, okay? And at the time it was built, it was the largest building in Upper Canada. It was humongous, right? In fact, it just closed in 2013, okay? The New York prison that it was modeled after is still functioning as a prison. Auburn, yeah. So the KP model required prisoners to live in total silence. They were forbidden from communicating or even gesturing to one another at all times. However, inmates were allowed to work and eat together during the day, but then they would return to their single cells at night. If they broke the rules, like they made a sound, or they looked at someone and gestured, they would be whipped. Men would be whipped, and women would be put in solitary confinement. These same punishments were used for children who were incarcerated as young as age 8. Okay? And the only sound in the KP system was the ringing of bells, which controlled their daily schedule and movement for meals, bedtime, work. When the bells would ring, the inmates would have to walk lockstep to the next destination. Now, during the last 100 years or so, we tried to refine this system, the same system, by the way. It's a system that's based on a belief in the deterrence theory. This is the idea that the threat of punishment or the viewing of others being punished will be enough to ensure that folks will choose to follow the rules. Mind you, the underlying assumption there with deterrence is that humans will engage in a cost-benefit analysis before they act to break the law. Now, I have long had doubts about deterrence theory, and it isn't just me. A lot of research has been conducted, and what we do know that most violent behavior is not ever pre-planned. Most offenders do engage in a risk assessment, or do not engage in a risk assessment before engaging in criminal behavior. And the death penalty does not eliminate the worst types of offenses. We know all that, okay? So how do we understand our reliance on deterrence and a system that has not achieved its mission after 200 years? Well, one possible explanation comes from Harold R. Johnson, who is a member of the Montreal Lake Cree Nation. Mr. Johnson decided to go to law school when he was 35 years old. While Mr. Johnson did not find the law hard to learn, he did find it hard to learn to think like a white man, which he says is what Harvard Law School requires you to do. So after graduating, he practiced law for several years before becoming a Crown prosecutor in Saskatchewan. And since retiring, he has written a few books with some critiques of our system. His most recent book came out last fall. It's called Peace and Good Order, The Case for Indigenous Justice in Canada. In this book, he writes, "Deterrence is a belief system, by which I mean that people believe it works. Showing someone evidence to the contrary, or contrary to their belief, will rarely dislodge it, because believing is something that does not require proof. It simply requires faith." So if I have faith, I don't need any evidence. Yeah. He goes on to say, "This particular belief in deterrence is peculiar to settler society and probably has roots in Judeo-Christian religion that believes in hell, fire, punishment for sins." And here we are at church. Where the difficulty comes in here is that belief in deterrence isn't like believing in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy. We don't have elaborate systems or power structures built around hiding eggs or teeth. We can give up our ideas that someone will give us money if we put our baby teeth under our pillow, right? It's pretty easy to give that up. But giving up belief in deterrence is more like giving up something you have always taken for granted as true. And that, my friends, can lead to an existential crisis, because we cannot imagine an alternative. Our world has enormous investments in deterrence, with people making a living on criminal law, corrections, ministries of justice, probation, parole, construction, you name it. In fact, we're getting a new prison here in Nanaimo. The system is huge, and many, many people depend on it continuing. So if we accept the idea that our system is based on a persistent belief that is resistant to change and impervious to evidence to the contrary, it still leaves us with one really big question. If deterrence does not work, then what are prisons for? My colleague Joanne Falvey and I are teaching a class in the Nanaimo Correctional Center with residents who learn alongside our VIU students. And a couple of weeks ago, we had a really interesting discussion with our class. We asked our students, what are prisons for? And they brainstormed ideas. They generated a list. And here's some of their ideas: to keep the public safe, to punish, to keep the public out and us in, to rehabilitate, to indoctrinate, to reform, to educate, to provide jobs, to teach inmates a lesson, to maintain the status quo, to make the public feel better, to get inmates to comply. Then we asked them, what are universities for? The second list generated had many parallels to the first. And interestingly, deterrence never came up once. No surprise. The truth is, our criminal justice system has been being reformed many, many times over and over again, but essentially it's the same system that came into play in the 1800s, essentially. The system stigmatizes those it punishes so that when they are released, and 99% of them will be, they will have difficulty reintegrating, getting a job, holding a job, getting housing, finding a partner, all of those things. Because the type of stigmatization that occurs with this system is disintegrative. There are few paths to success once you have a criminal record. The system ultimately results in limiting your options, making your world smaller, restricting your future. But there is something different happening now. And it all started, well, it started in Canada in 1974. That's a long time ago. In Elmira, Ontario, there was a vandalism spree underway. And the perpetrators turned out to be a couple of intoxicated young men. When the men were caught, they were sent home to await their court dates. But as luck would have it, the universe sometimes is amazing, they were assigned a probation officer who was a dreamer. His name was Mark Yancey. He'd been a probation officer for 5 years, and he longed to do justice differently. He wondered, man, wouldn't it be neat if offenders could meet the victims of their offenses? He liked the idea, right, of victims meeting offenders like they do in other peacemaking diplomacy or treaties, other peacemaking activities. But Mark didn't think a judge would ever consider such a thing. However, he was a Mennonite, and his friends in the Mennonite community encouraged him to at least give it a try. So when he submitted his pre-sentence report, those are PSRs, to the judge, he suggested that there might be therapeutic value for these young men if they could meet the people they'd harmed. The judge didn't think it was possible for him to order offenders to meet the victims, but when the case was heard, the judge ordered a one-month remand to allow time for the boys to meet the victims. His ruling surprised everyone, including the offenders. The two offenders then were accompanied by their probation officer to visit each of the places where they had vandalized. They had to meet with 21 victims. When the youth returned to court a month later, the judge ordered a fine plus restitution and a term of probation. And the experience of personally meeting with the offenders was very transformative for those young men. They ended up paying back all the victims for all of the damage they had done. And that was the first experimental case in Canada. And that program became known as Victim Offender Mediation Program. And different forms of it exist today. But since then, about 20 years ago, the restorative justice really started catching on. And it's because of growing awareness that the system, wow, it's really loud, growing awareness that far and wide that the system really wasn't meeting the needs of victims, of offenders, are of communities. And we were incarcerating far too many people. To start with, our criminal justice system fails to meet the needs of victims. Instead of empowering them, the system often leaves them feeling ignored, neglected, or even re-victimized. The system is made to view criminal violations differently than other rule breaking. If you violate a criminal law, your crime is against the state, not the victim. So the process is between the state and the offender. The victim is not involved. Maybe as a witness, but that's it. Okay? That reality leaves victims feeling largely ignored. Victims frequently report they don't get any answers to the most important questions they have about the offense, or even the opportunity to tell their story. And telling one's story is really important to most victims. For some victims, restitution or vindication is important, and the system mostly denies them that opportunity as well. Often, victims feel that they lost control. It's been taken away from them with the crime, and the involvement in the case would help give them back some of that power. The most frequent question victims want answered is never answered. You know what question that is? Why me? Our system doesn't help them get that answer. So instead, RJ, Restorative Justice, seeks to address all of those needs of the victim. But it isn't just the victims, though. Offenders have needs, too, and the system fails to address these. The system is concerned with holding offenders accountable. What that means in practice, though, is making sure that they receive their just desserts. Yeah. That means serving time and being punished. As a result, offenders do not get the opportunity to understand the consequences of their actions or to even recognize the harms they've caused others. The whole process is adversarial, so offenders have to play a game because they try to get the least punishment possible. That means the system pushes offenders to not acknowledge responsibility for hurt people. The process separates offenders and victims, guaranteeing that offenders will feel no connection, no empathy. And we lose all of that in exchange for a lighter sentence. Punishment is not real accountability for one's actions. Accountability comes one way, and that's from taking steps to put things right. Putting things right as best as possible is better for victims, it's better for society, and it's better for offenders. The underlying principles of RJ go back to the roots of humanity, long, long before we had a criminal code. RJ is based on three principles. The first is, crime is a violation of people and of personal relationships, interpersonal relationships. It's not a violation of a rule or a law, but of our connection to one another. Okay? The second principle is that violations create obligations. If something I do harms another, I am obliged to do something about it to make it right. The central obligation, number three, the central obligation is to put right the wrongs. The onus, then, is always on the actor. The first time I read about those principles in Howard Zaire's book on restorative justice, I was struck by how Unitarian they sounded and how aligned they are to our UU principles. As UUs, our central obligation is to put right the wrongs. This is our obligation to each other and within our communities. And that is extraordinarily different than the system that has been in operation for these 200 years. Let me highlight a few differences. On the one hand, the criminal justice system views crime as a violation of the law and the state. RJ views crime as a violation of people and relationships. Okay? The justice system believes that violations create guilt. RJ asserts that violations create obligations. The existing system argues that justice requires the state to determine blame and to impose pain, punishment, guilt and punishment, right? RJ's position is that justice involves victims, offenders, and community members coming together in an effort to make things right. So, for the justice system, the central focus is always on offenders getting just desserts, and for RJ, the central focus is always on victims getting what she needs or he needs, and an offender taking responsibility for repairing that harm. These different focuses affect the questions one must ask when dealing with a broken rule. If I am a Crown prosecutor in this current system, I have three questions to answer. One, what laws have been broken? Two, who did it? Who's guilty here? Three, what do they deserve? The victim is nowhere in that process. If I'm a restorative justice practitioner, I have three different questions. One, who has been hurt? Two, what are their needs? Three, Whose obligations are these? Here, the focus is on harm and how to make it right. Today, there are a number of programs in the U.S. and Canada that are guided by RJ principles. There's not enough. Some processes are used primarily with youth, and in my university, we use an RJ approach to conflict. Here in Nanaimo, we have family group conferences that are facilitated through the John Howard Society and a number of sentencing circles that include community members, victims, and offenders. However, the majority of cases are still being dealt with using our original punitive system. I believe it would behoove us to flip that so that the majority of cases are treated using an RJ approach. Having worked with incarcerated individuals for quite a few years now, I think it is really important to point out the fact that most persons who have come into conflict with the law, in my experience, don't just have victims. They are victims. They were victims. And I cannot emphasize enough that hurt people hurt people. Peacemaking criminologists summarize this in a way that I believe is easy to understand, so I always like to teach it in my classes. But their belief is that the core principle behind crime is that suffering causes crime. We need to stop the suffering. Stigmatizing behavior that harms other people is not a bad thing, but RJ relies on reintegrative stigmatization rather than disintegrative, which our current system uses. In other words, the use of remorse and recognition of the obligation to take responsibility for fixing what you broke, okay, that gives offenders a path back into the good graces of community, enabling them to be reintegrated and back in good standing. That is dignified. That is educational, because it shames behaviors, not people. That is what our system should be. It should be a system that involves the whole community working to enable rule breakers to take responsibility for the hurts they cause and to make right their wrongs. That aligns with Unitarian principles. So what is a more just world? Well, to me, it's a world where we shift our practice for dealing with unjust actions to one focused on those who are harmed. What do they need? And the facilitation of an offender's actions to repair the harm and restore things back to how they were, or as near as possible. Next time you read a news story about a crime or learn about someone being arrested, I hope you consider reframing how you think about it so that you can ask, who has been hurt? What are their needs? Whose obligation is this? Thank you.